Richard Dietrich.
Thank you. I'm going to take my position that I often do of being a contrarian, but this time I'm not sure who I'm opposed to, but so maybe it's the board. I want to begin by reinforcing, I hope, what Barbara Roper said a minute ago, and that is my interpretation of what's happening here overall is that this is another failure of financial reporting in the following way. People don't trust the financial statements. I received recently a set of data that showed market-to-book ratios for a variety of banks in the United States. And the ratio that I found to be most interesting was 0.08. That is, the market price of one bank was 8% of the book value of that bank's, according to its financial statements. What does that tell me, either about how people are pricing things right now in the marketplace or what the financial information in the balance sheet's really telling us? And so I think we have to be very concerned about what's really going on right now and our financial statements reflecting. It's consistent with this story about why people don't trade with each other. They don't trust the information. Catherine Schipper recently had a very eloquent statement on the importance of information for creating markets that function well. And when those when that information breaks down, the markets break down. And so to an extent that we've seen several trillion dollars wiped off the books recently, we really should be asking ourselves to what extent are those who are responsible for preparing information under which markets work effectively challenging those who set about doing that. So the question about whether we're over-auditing, the question about fair value measures are important questions to ask. But somebody has to stand up and say that we're losing a couple trillion dollars in value here if we don't get it right. So to that extent, one of the other things that I want to mention is, first, to whom are you addressing this potential statement? Your question says to assist auditors in their upcoming audits. Well, it seems to me that those should be the last people who need this assistance in the following way. The rest of this session is going to be talking about audit quality. If we have quality auditors, then the auditors already should do this. Ben Coleman alluded to that in his statements when said basically that they've already been messaging to their people virtually everything, if not more, than is in this statement. So a quality auditing firm is not going to learn much from this. Their clients might, and other investors might. So what you might think about in preparing this statement is, who really is the audience for this? You can say it's for the auditors, but if it really is for the auditors, we have a much more important problem, because the auditors should be thinking of these issues every year if they're going to do high-quality audits. And in fact, they should be thinking more in a contextual way for specific clients beyond anything you can put in the letter, unless you're going to put in everything that auditors need to think about all the time. So I really think that the focus on this has to be for everybody else, and really get back to the point that Barbara made earlier. Auditors do a very important job. Last point that I want to raise, and maybe somebody else can talk about it, is how's this going to affect audit fees for this year? I have heard that there's tremendous downward pressure on audit fees right now. What we're talking about is raising the amount of work that auditors are going to have to do. And I think that workload is going to go up substantially in order to address all of these questions and restore the integrity in the financial reporting process. So how are we going to address that? So one of the other things that you might want to consider is how you can have investors and audit committees understand that paying more for audit fees this year to make sure that these audit issues are well addressed may be one of the best uses that they can have for the stockholders' funds. Thank you.
Thank you. Ernie Ball.
Thank you. I want to agree with Dick on his comment regarding audit fees going up. If they don't go up this year, then somebody's not doing what they ought to be doing. And I think that our clients should anticipate that. As far as the type of issue we have listed, that may be most significant. It's my opinion that the going concern issue is probably the most significant. It bears on virtually all the other issues that we have listed. All of those things come into being with the going concern decision, and I think that needs to be emphasized.
Thank you. Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I don't have a basis for recommending whether or not additional audit guidance is necessary in any of these areas, but as far as the issue of which of these areas are most significant, I would focus on three that you mentioned, at least from an investor perspective. The first one being fair value measurements. I was struck by an October letter from the American Banker Association to SEC Chairman Cox that indicated that a number of financial institutions, both large and small, at least the way I read the letter, are unlikely to comply with FSP 157.3 that you mentioned earlier. My reading of 157.3 is that it's an illustrative example of a principle that's in 157. So that raises concerns on my part as to whether or not some financial institutions, referring to their letter, large and small, are not complying with the principles in 157. That same letter also talks about other than temporary impairment, another issue you mentioned. You pointed out that it was a highly judgmental area. Your memo, though, however, also points out that we've had some guidance in that area for quite some time. There's guidance, as you mentioned, 115, SAB 59, EITF 9920. So again, based on comments in that letter and other comments I've seen publicly made, it raises an issue to me as to whether or not other than temporary impairment requirements as they exist today are being complied with. I would also point out Kurt's organization, CFA Institute, conducted a survey recently of their membership regarding what their members believe contributed to continuing volatility. And 75% of the membership, with one being not at all and five completely, 75% of their membership gave a rating of four or five to the concern that financial institutions continue to hold assets at values that do not accurately reflect current market value. So again, I think that suggests to me that those two areas, fair value measurements, other than temporary impairment, are significant areas. And the third one I'd point out, and another one that was on your list, was disclosures. Your memo talks about when there's volatility and given this economic environment that disclosures are very important. You mentioned risk and uncertainty. Certainly that seems to be an important one. But also there's some very good disclosures in 157 that many investors have been relying on or have found very helpful. Your memo also points out there's new disclosures that the FASB has issued on credit derivatives, which seems like another very pertinent area, another set of important disclosures. So I think those three areas are most significant: fair value measurement, other than temporary impairment, and the disclosure area. Thank you.
Thank you. Lynn Turner.
I'd like to just come back to something that Dick said and maybe direct a question down to John on the MD&As, which do tie into a lot of this and ultimately what happens in the disclosures. Now, my experience has been is if you give up, if you give the companies a heads up that here's the things you're going to focus on in reviews and all, and then someone like the PCLB comes in and says, here's what we're going to focus on in our inspections next year coming out of it, the people respond to that in a positive way. The companies usually then try to make sure that they do a good job of getting disclosure in those areas, and then the audit committees will spend more time, and so will the auditors, and it has a very positive outcome. Is the SEC, other than just in speeches, looking or considering something there in CorpFin, putting out some guidance? We've got almost a once-in-a-lifetime type fundamental shift going on in the economy and what companies are facing. Have the staff considered putting out some type of alert as well, saying here are some things that people just need to be thinking about as they prepare their filings, and not just the things that are going to come out of TARP, because I think you've been out there talking about the implications of that for filings, but in general, just the reset that's going on in the economy, not only here but globally. Have you guys considered putting out
something that says, hey, here's the things you need to be thinking at with the hope of improving disclosures that you're in?
Well, obviously, to this point, we've been doing it in, I guess I would say, small pieces since, I guess, all the way back to last December, even some thoughts that we put out, that I put out in a speech yesterday. I don't know that we've gotten far enough along to think whether we'd do something more comprehensive than that. I mean, I do think you'll see some more thoughts maybe in the 157 area.
I'd certainly encourage you to do something broader and kind of pull it all together. I think it was last year or the year before you put something out. Divisions put out things in the past of what it's focusing on.
There was something two or three years ago that was actually kind of an odd release at the time.
I would certainly encourage you to do it because we are going through a once-in-a-lifetime type event. I can't help but think it won't work out good for everyone if you guys would be willing to do that.
Okay, thank you. Joe Carcello.
A couple of things. In terms of what areas may be most important, kind of add some things to what has already been said. I think they're all important, but I'd probably pick four. One is going concern, which I think has been said already. The other is fraud. And the reason I say those two is because when the auditor is perceived to have failed in those two areas, it creates a major problem with the public. And when it creates a major problem with the public, it creates problems, obviously, for Congress and regulators. And so it's just a big issue. I think that's what investors focus on most closely is missing fraud. And to a lesser extent, missing a bankruptcy shortly after it happens. The third thing would be revenue recognition. In the work that I've done in fraud and others have done in fraud, and I think Walter Schutz one time said, when it comes to fraud, cooking the books, improper revenue recognition is the recipe of choice. And so they just tend to go there. And then the last would be fair value, which has also been said. And the reason for that is that's what everybody expects the auditor to be focusing on now, right? So if you miss it in fair value, people are going to say, well, are you alive? Everybody's focusing on that. So I think those would be the four areas. I want to respond a little bit to what Dick said. I don't disagree that the guidance could be very useful to management and to investors. And Dick said it shouldn't be useful to auditors. If it is useful to auditors, we got bigger problems. And I would agree with Dick that I think the major firms and probably some of the large regionals should be all over this. But Dick, I don't know if you've ever done CPE for some firms that are registered with the board. And unless the people in Ohio are a whole lot smarter, and maybe they are, the questions that I get are downright frightening. So I do think that there are some auditors who could benefit from this guidance. They don't have the luxury of the staff that Vin has in New York thinking about this stuff all the time. And then the last thing that I'd say is on the fee area, I do think the auditors are going to have to do more work, and I do think that has obvious implications for fees, and I do think they probably are having a lot of pressure put on them right now as it relates to fees. One of the things I would hope that the board is doing in their inspection process is if firm A is doing an audit, and we'll just pick a number, for $5 million, and then the client switches to firm B, and firm B is doing the audit for $4 million. I hope the inspection staff is saying, well, why are you guys so much smarter and so much better than firm A, particularly assuming these are both large firms? And unless there's a very persuasive answer there, that sounds to me like fee cutting. And in reality, most of the costs associated with an audit is professional practice time. So in all likely, hours have gone down, which you guys have the data to look at. And so if hours have gone down in this kind of environment, as a regulator, I hope you're troubled by that.
Thank you. David Becker.
Just very quickly to suggest a way perhaps of thinking through the question of whether you should issue guidance. It strikes me that guidance from regulators serves one of maybe four purposes, and I would think you ought to maybe look at this in this framework if it's useful. The first is is to clear up some sort of ambiguity. People don't know what they're supposed to do, perhaps because the standards are either too particular or too general. We'll deal with that another time. The second is to remind people about what they ought to do, sort of literally remind them, oh, this is very complicated, I don't know, I forgot about that. Good thing you reminded me, PCAOB, which strikes me as that might be a little odd, but you never know. The third is to remind in a sort of finger-wagging way, which is to say, we don't have enough confidence that you're going to get it right without us putting some implied pressure on you. So we want to, quote, remind, unquote, auditors that they have to do X, Y, and Z. And then the fourth thing, it strikes me, that one might usefully do is to say, well, we want to issue a statement because we want to strengthen the hand of auditors in the eternal guerrilla warfare between auditors and management, so that when or the company, so that when the auditor is importuned not to do X, Y, and Z because it costs so much or because it leads to unpleasant result, the auditor can say, you know, I might be tempted to agree with you. But, you know, those crazy guys at the PCAOB, they just sent this thing out telling us that we had to make sure that we did these things. So that, again, that just sort of strikes me as if one thinks of this in terms of the public policy objectives to be achieved by issuing guidance, I think it may help you through it.
David, I'm just kind of wondering, that's, I think, a helpful list of things to think about. Based on the discussion today, is there anything that you would think would trigger, do we meet any one of those four categories for a need for guidance? Just interested in your observations.
Well, I'm concerned that there hasn't been any discussion about the potential decline in legal fees. Beyond that, I don't think I have anything to add to the discussion. It's quite good.
But as I understood it, David, you were suggesting that we make sure that we answer one of these four questions before we issue the guidance. Were we clearing up an ambiguity, something ambiguous? Was it so important that we needed to remind people because it was just so urgent? Or maybe the guidance does, even though it repeats something out there, strengthens the hand. So you're suggesting we, in thinking this through, make sure we think of what we believe the reason is for the guidance. Yeah, I think it's very valuable. Thank you.
Larry Salva.
David's comments may have been a good setup for mine, in that to try go back to answer some of the questions of what might be most significant to address. I think that largely depends on the circumstances of each company, and you know, in each situation, industries are going to be different, companies are going to be affected differently, and also it depends on the guidance, if you will, that is put out, or whether it's in fact guidance meeting one of the purposes that David outlined, or possibly a different purpose, which I think of as there are three parties involved here: the issuer, or the preparer, the auditor, and the audit committee. And I think the objective here could be that we want to improve the quality of each of those, quality of the financial reporting, the quality of the audit of that financial reporting by the preparer, and the quality of the oversight of the preparation of the financial reporting and the auditing of that by the audit committee. Now, I recognize that the mission of the PCAOB is primarily to deal with the auditing profession, but as others have mentioned here, SOX puts a responsibility on management to have internal control over financial reporting, which clearly is implicated here if management fails to identify either the implications of the current environment on their financial reporting accounting as well as disclosures. While SOX doesn't technically get to MD&A, Lynn rightly pointed out that SAS 8 does put responsibilities on the auditor to read it for consistency, including the description of the business, how the business might be evolving, which might not even be in the MD&A, but might be in the description of business section of the fore part of the 10K. So my view technically, you know, I guess, is more of this really needs to be a risk alert. That would be the kind of guidance that I think would be appropriate. And it could be a risk alert that is a financial reporting and audit risk alert that would be read by all constituents so that they could all do their respective jobs in the role of interplay between audit committee oversight. We'll all read it, and we'll all think about what applies in our circumstances and react appropriately, hopefully all react appropriately. But the objective very much could be to improve the quality of each one of those aspects of financial reporting.
We do have that tool, risk alert, effectively practice alert, which is the tool we used last year to issue guidance on fair value measurements. So that is a tool that could be the vehicle for this guidance. Thanks.
Sam Renzella.
Well, let me try to react to what have been so far some very constructive comments. We have been at KPMG, we've been targeting all of these issues to some degree or not, for this has been now about 16 to 18 months that we've been living in this world, and it's been accelerating. So we've been putting out guidance for some time around these particular issues. We think we know what, we believe we've got our hands around the risks. We're putting out, to Larry's point, you've got to really dig down into the industry and sector levels now to really start to focus on, because certain sectors have moved into the crisis that weren't there maybe 6 months ago, so we're working on sector-led guidance. So I don't, just speaking for us, I don't think we're looking for anything directly from the board, but surely would not object to something along the lines that Larry talked about, which is a risk alert with a focus on financial reporting as well. The last thing I would like to cover is David Becker's comments around the four reasons one might put out guidance. And the last one, which would be for auditors to have I'll embellish here a bit, auditors to have a stick to throw in front of their clients on why they might be doing something. I just assume we didn't have that. We're all big boys and big girls, and we know what the requirements are, and I think we can explain to our clients why we believe a procedure is necessary and not look to the board with respect to blaming why we might be doing something. I would hope that we'd have enough judgment and enough integrity to do that without that need.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
I happen to agree with you on that last comment, Sam. I don't know what kind of stick you'd give to the auditor anyway, and I think a lot of what we're talking about here is already out there. I mean, the guidance is there. Maybe it's a practice alert reminder of some sort. There's actually a lot of information on going concern. I am troubled, though, by the 94-6, the risks and uncertainties. Why are not these things being disclosed in financial statement footnotes? Why aren't they being discussed more in MD&A? And to that extent, I think that would be a ripe area for some additional reminders. You know, how many of these people have actually read 94-6? You've got to wonder, given the content of that, based on what we've been seeing happening, particularly in the area of what it talks about, severe impact and severe impact within the next 12 months, and whether those sorts of things are being disclosed in the footnotes. Lynn mentioned earlier, you know, the auditor's responsibility to read the document. I think more definitive guidance has always been questionable in terms of what is expected in with particular MD&A, And an MD&A, you know, you read it, and then what do you do with it? Should there be some sort of reporting responsibility in connection with that, I think, has always been an open question.
Kurt Schott.
I just have to say that your guidance and your support and your hand-holding and even reminders in this moment have to be welcomed and encouraged in all cases, in our view. On the issue of going concern, there has been some discussion in our organization amongst our members about how audit will handle or should handle and assess and report on firms that are participating and somewhat dependent on the TARP program, the equity infusion program, the money market guarantee program, the commercial paper guarantee program, if I missed any. How is that to be dealt with in terms of the going concern analysis?
John Morrissey.
Yeah, thank you. I guess just a couple points. I think it's a good list as usual. I think it's very insightful, like, you know, in violent agreement with virtually the views that have been put forward today. I would like to address two points. One was the question of whether or not the auditors understand what the new risks are and where the areas of focus should be. On the receiving end of the floggings that have increased in the severity, I can tell you they do get it, and they're communicating it to their clients, and they're also been very good about communicating that it's going to cost more, and I think that's all fair. But just from one person's perspective, I can tell you they get it, but certainly wouldn't hurt to reinforce the guidance and get it out there for all to see, not just auditors. The other thing I'd ask you to think about is that the list that you put forward is a great list for today. The pressures that the economy is under today and the auditors are under today and companies are under today. But if you look forward even further and you're hopeful like I am, things are going to improve and things are going to start getting better. And as we emerge from this, other things are going to become interesting as well. And what kind of brought this to focus for me was I was reading a transcript of a CFO that was saying, we had a $2.5 billion loss this quarter related to mark-to-market adjustments. We think our actual losses are going to be in the range of $100,000 to $200,000. And I started thinking about that, and I said, wow, if this guy's right, and he seemed like a pretty smart guy, when this starts to turn, he's sitting on over $2 billion of profits that are going to come out at some point. And I started thinking, I wonder how that's going to come out. Things tend to go down pretty quickly. Gravity with auditors tends to be something that they like. But going the other way, it's going to be interesting to see how quickly it goes back up, how quickly it should go back up, and whether or not the market reacts to those increases in they like it better in big lumps or they like it better in small pieces. And it's just going to be really interesting. There's going to, I think, need to be some sensitivity to what happens down the road as we start to kind of go out of the cycle, which hopefully we will soon. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. And I think we've observed that in financial reporting in the past where coming out of cycles, very large reserves were built up, and then how were they dealt with in future financial reporting? So your comment is a good reminder that it's not just on the downside, that as things turn around on the upside, accounting issues emerge as well, and auditing issues.
Howard Johnson.
One other aspect to take a look at, since nobody else has mentioned it, is perhaps if you can issue some guidance about something about looking at the consistency and perhaps more involvement in the quarterly review of the financials. Although it's not an audit, and you're reading a lot of stuff, it is an opportunity to ask a lot of probing questions on a lot of these topics, which may be appropriate. You know, some of these topics are more appropriate to some organizations than others, but you could tailor them. To me, it's an opportunity that you wouldn't want to miss. It's also a chance to perhaps take a look at the governance process and meet with some of the key players in the governance process within that organization. Internal auditors, legal, risk management folks, finance personnel. See if what's going on with their groups, any changes in reporting relationships. Did anybody just hike up and leave for no reason? That kind of thing. I think it also matches things like the audit committee is interested in. What's going on with the management or the governance process and organization. So I add that to the hopper.
Thank you. John Kellis.
Thank you. A lot of interesting points have been raised, and sometimes you just have to issue guidance of this sort, but I think the points about the purpose of the guidance are extremely important, and I think that before preparing or issuing any further guidance, that you ought to be very clear as to your purpose in doing this. In principle, I'm with Mr. Dietrich, who says surely this isn't necessary for auditors, but to the extent that there are comments that are making the point that yes, there are indeed auditors who need some assistance in this way, then that provides a rationale for producing guidance and also may help in its focus. And it seems to me that PCAOB is in a particularly special position to have an idea as to what sort of guidance auditors might require because of your inspection system, and you may or may not, but you may have seen weaknesses in the past which in the current environment become more important. The second point, though, is there is an awful lot of guidance floating about, and I think that if one is just issuing guidance for the sake of it, one ought to not to do so, because at present there's a sense in which preparers, auditors, everyone is being overburdened with assistance, and particularly if you look internationally where many jurisdictions are producing guidance. And related to that is the question of consistency, and an example of that arose recently in the fact that the International Accounting Standards Board has been preparing a paper on fair value measurement and disclosure by some experts, which have been produced in draft. After that had been produced in draft, FASB and the SEC issued some questions and answers. I think it was probably the SEC, the tone of which, never mind the substance, the tone of which was rather different from the IASB's guidance, and this was followed by a statement by IASB that it was all the same. And really what it comes down to is the more that you say about things, the more you run the risk of different nuances coming out, and the more you run the risk of confusing those who you are actually intending to help.
Thank you. Lynn Turner.
I think David's points about why to do it are pretty good. I think it does help the auditors in some difficult positions, although I hate when the auditors come in to me in an audit committee and say, hey, we got to do this because PCLB put out some guidance, when it's just common sense to turn around and do it. So I'd hope the auditors wouldn't do it, but I think David's right on with why to do it. And this is all about human behavior. And, you know, if you can buck up the auditors a little bit in what is probably the toughest job in business, then so be it. I think that's beneficial. They're going to have a very, very tough job this year. And if you can help them out a little bit, I'd certainly encourage you to do that. There are a couple other points, though. When you look back over the past and you see where the auditors didn't get the job done right, quite often information was out there that they didn't pay attention to. There were red flags, information available in the marketplace, and one thought that comes to mind is on Lehman Brothers, over a year ago, I was getting a number of questions from investors as well as from the media, seriously challenging whether or not you could trust any of their valuations on their assets, especially some of their portfolios. And you had a large group of people already questioning what was going into that financial statement. And certainly when I was at Glass Lewis, we looked at the information that the firms used, and I think quite often the auditors, the audit teams weren't getting all the information, for example, that was available to the street, and weren't factoring that in, and I think that's incredibly useful information. I think the auditors, especially this year, are going to need to take off the blinders and consider everything. Someone mentioned the governance stuff. There's the compensation stuff that people are going to have to take a look at. Why are people in such... I think this is a year where you'd probably need to spend more time with the operational people than with the finance and accounting groups. It's the operational people that are going to know how you're going to come out and going to do. And I think if the auditors sit there in the audit room and don't get out and spend some time with the top divisional people and the top operating officers, they're going to miss the boat there. Another one is on the whistleblower program. Someone mentioned fraud. And we now know from some research that auditors, internal or external, just typically do not find fraud. They're the lowest detector of that there is. And the highest detection source seems to be the whistleblower programs or TIPS. And yet I found that audit partners don't understand whether or not the whistleblower programs are working within the organizations, how they work, where they're working, and whether or not they're really independently sourcing those tips up to the audit committee or an independent source outside of management. And I think it would be, especially as pressure goes on to management to make the numbers, areas like revenue recognition have been mentioned, I don't understand how auditors could not literally this year go in and look at the whistleblower programs, really understand whether they're working or not, and make sure they've got their hands around that, because that is the number one detector of fraud. The auditors are also starting to send some of this work offshore to India and elsewhere to be done. And I think the auditors, as they start to go offshore with this work and have more of the audit work done outside the country, some of the basic audit work, I think they have to make sure they've got the right controls or supervision, because God save them if they have one of these audits blow up and it turns out that that audit work was done over in India. That will be a front page New York Times article. And God won't be able to save you from the outcome on that one if there's a problem. So I think people need to be aware as they change the way they're doing audits in a scenario like this, they have to be sensitive to that.
Thank you. Craig Jonas.
Thanks, Jennifer. Now let me violently pile on to something Larry Selvis said. And when he was speaking, I was reminded of the trip my wife and I took down the Colorado River in a dory. And we were going down the river with guides who had been doing this for 25-plus years, and they were very skilled at it. But without fail, prior to getting to a Class 5 rapids, they would pull off to the side, and they'd get out, and they'd talk about the rapids. Scouting, they called it, scouting the rapids. But the notion was, look down the rapid and say, see that big rock to the left? Stay right. You know, yesterday I saw a guy, he crashed into the rock just in front of it. Stay left. It's kind of a risk alert. Where are the big rocks? Who crashed last time around? And let's be wise about trying to avoid it. It's very much of a coaching kind of tone, as opposed to a tone of, you know, you've got 521 things you need to do, and let me just count them for you. This is much more of a let me help you keep out of trouble kind of tone. And I remember in practice, it was among the best memos I would read during the year, because you read it with your own clients in mind, specific companies in mind, and you think as you go about, oh my gosh, yes, I've got that problem. And it might not even be the exact problem, it's an analogous problem, but you triggered a thought. And I think that's the highest and best use of the document, is to trigger the creative thought needed to spot the rocks and stay left or right as appropriate in the circumstances. If you bought into that logic, key to making this work then are two things. One, avoid the temptation to take a list of 20 items and say the top two are these, because they're very client dependent. You know, fair value may be very relevant for a firm heavy into financial instruments. It may be irrelevant to a widget maker. But inventory obsolescence is everything, maybe to the widget maker. And then the last point I'll make is time is relevant here too. There's a cycle that the audit firms go through, that companies go through, of course, in preparing their books and records. And, you know, the time to sit and reflect about this is often over the holidays. So like by Thanksgiving, wouldn't it be great to have something in people's hands that they could sit and read and reflect? These are kind of reflective documents. They're not study, take notes, kind of, but reflective kind of documents. And hopefully by Thanksgiving would be a time to have it out, best case, I would think.
Thanks for those comments.